From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as the world mourns the death of Nelson Mandela, we have a special report looking at the former South African president's relationship with the United States, from the earliest contacts with US officials.
One of the things I remember about that meeting is that he still was clinging to the idea of nationalizing the economy.
To his criticism of the war in Iraq.
True democracy cannot be imposed. Not transplanted.
We talked to lawmakers, activists and celebrities who worked with him and witnessed history.
You know, I asked him why he wanted to meet me and why would he want to meet such a controversial person. He said, just because I know you'll spread the word.
That's coming up on this special edition of FSN Reports after our summary of the day's headlines. From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. US Secretary of State John Kerry has returned to the Middle East to boost troubled peace negotiations, with options for a deal for both sides to consider. The plan covers core issues in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including the final borders for two states, claims to Jerusalem, and the fate of Palestinian refugees. Nina Maria Potts has more.
Details on the US brokered peace plan are sketchy because the negotiation process is meant to be confidential. But reports say US Secretary of State John Kerry is back in the Middle East to try and lend momentum to the peace talks. State Department sources have been briefing that the US does not intend to impose a peace deal, but that John Kerry will offer proposals that will help bridge the gap between the two sides. The US brokered negotiations began in late July and were set to run 9 months, but have run into trouble in recent weeks because of Palestinian violence and Israeli efforts to shore up its presence in the West Bank. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
Officials and vendors say the January 1st opening of recreational marijuana shops in Colorado went smoothly. On New Year's Day, Colorado became the first US state to open pot shops where anyone over 21 can purchase the drug. Denver correspondent Mary McCarthy reports.
Denver's so-called marijuana czar, Ashley Kilroy, said there were no disturbances or major complaints on the first day of sales at retail marijuana shops in Colorado. Tony Fox runs 3D Discreet Dispensary. She was encouraging responsible use.
Denver has created a small postcard handout, and then we also have an industry-created pamphlet about marijuana in Colorado, the do's and don'ts, what's legal, what's not.
The majority of customers at 3D and many dispensaries in Denver were hot tourists who traveled to Colorado from other states. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
The New York Times has published an editorial calling for the Obama administration to broker a plea bargain deal with whistleblower Edward Snowden. The paper argues that Snowden, who leaked thousands of classified documents about America's National Security Agency, has done his country a great service. From New York, Nick Harper has the story.
The New York Times editorial says Edward Snowden faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life looking over his shoulder. He remains in exile in Russia, facing US charges of espionage and theft. It's after he disclosed thousands of secret documents about America's National Security Agency's surveillance programs. The New York Times admits that Snowden did commit a crime, but argues there was enormous value to the information he revealed, and therefore deserves better than a life of what it calls fear and flight. It calls for the US government to offer him a plea bargain that would allow him to return home and face at least a substantially reduced sentence. Nick Harper, New York.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Five people have been killed and dozens injured after a car bomb detonated in Beirut, Lebanon. The attack, the latest in a series to hit the city, has been linked to the ongoing war in neighbouring Syria, in particular the role of Hezbollah in the conflict. The latest bomb blast comes as Saudi Arabia agreed $3 billion of military aid to Lebanon. Christian Science Monitor's Beirut correspondent Nicholas Blanford says the deal has received a mixed reaction.
So the idea is that if the Saudis are willing to pay $3 billion to upgrade the Lebanese army's capabilities, there won't be such a need for Hezbollah to maintain its formidable arsenal. And for that exact reason, Hezbollah and his political allies here have eyed this donation by the Saudis with a certain amount of suspicion. There's been a guarded welcome for it in principle, but a lot of people are wondering what kind of political strings are going to come with this deal.
And finally, after 4 years in a federal prison in Texas, 74-year-old activist and lawyer Lynn Stewart was granted compassionate release on New Year's Eve. The Federal Bureau of Prisons said her age and her advanced terminal cancer made her unlikely to pose any threat to her community. Alice Olstein has more.
She was convicted of material support for terrorism after representing convicted terrorist Omar Abdelrahman and passing a message from him in prison to his supporters in Egypt. That message was asking them to support a ceasefire. Speaking to FSN from outside Stewart's probation meeting, her husband Ralph Pointer said now that her jail sentence has been lifted, she can better battle what he calls the death sentence of stage 4 breast cancer.
We don't ever want to say die. It is a very strong possibility that she will die within 8 months to a year.
Pointer brought her back to New York City, where she will undergo medical treatment and live with her family in Brooklyn. Alice Olstein, Washington.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Kevin McAleese reporting. From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Today, we bring you another opportunity to hear a special FSN documentary about Nelson Mandela and his relationship with the United States. As you'll hear, it wasn't always plain sailing. Before the South African statesman's death, we talked with former secretaries of state, lawmakers, activists, and celebrities about their experiences working with one of the great international statesmen of all time. FSN's Simon Marks hosts Strange Bedfellows, Nelson Mandela and the United States.
If there was a day that symbolized America's universal admiration for Nelson Mandela, it was September the 23rd, 1998. The South African president had been to Washington many times before, but this day was different. Beneath the dome of the US Capitol, South Africa's leader was feted by politicians of all stripes, becoming the first African ever to be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal, the greatest honor in the gift of American lawmakers.
Americans as one today, across all the lines that divide us, pay tribute to your struggle, to your achievement, and to the inspiration you have given us to do better.
I am conscious that in bestowing the Congressional Gold Medal upon me, you are evoking these bonds between our nations and paying tribute to the whole South African nation for its achievements in realizing our shared ideal.
In many ways, that day served as the high point in a complex, layered, and sometimes difficult relationship between Nelson Mandela and the USA. The smiles and generous speeches that September afternoon reflected America's esteem for a man who had led his country out of the racial, economic, and political abyss. But what he called his long walk to freedom had also given rise to another long walk towards a productive relationship with the USA.
When he was released, and it happened to coincide with the trip that I was making to Namibia for its independence celebration, it was a wonderful time to be able to sit down with him.
That meeting with then Secretary of State James Baker came just 2 months after Nelson Mandela's dusty progress out of the Victor Verster prison in South Africa. And the US was worried. Nelson Mandela, after all, was the leader of a left-wing political movement. It had waged a violent revolutionary struggle against its opponents and was closely allied with South Africa's Communist Party.
One of the things I remember about that meeting is that he still was clinging to the idea of nationalizing the economy of South Africa, almost in a communist approach, and he was ideologically still, I felt, sort of locked in a time warp where it came to economic matters as opposed to political matters. And we were trying to dissuade him from that approach, trying to convince him that the free market was the way to go.
Freedom! Freedom! US concerns about Nelson Mandela's political reflexes were nothing new. It's almost hard to imagine now, but as the struggle against apartheid dominated the news from South Africa throughout the 1970s and 80s, in Washington there were heated debates about the direction US policy should take. The debates were fueled by Nelson Mandela's own left-wing political credentials, the ANC's Cold War ties with Soviet leaders in Moscow, and its association with Yasser Arafat, Muammar Gaddafi, and Saddam Hussein, an array of international figures on Washington's enemies list.
But the South African government is under no obligation to negotiate the future of the country with any organization that proclaims a goal of creating a communist state and uses terrorist tactics and violence to achieve it.
While South Africa's future president was in jail, Ronald Reagan's partner in London, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, was calling dreams of black majority rule in South Africa cloud cuckoo land. And President Reagan himself fought tooth and nail against moves to impose economic sanctions on the whites-only government in Pretoria.
The primary victims of an economic boycott of South Africa would be the very people we seek to help. Most of the workers who would lose jobs because of sanctions would be black workers. We do not believe the way to help the people of South Africa is to cripple the economy upon which they and their families depend for survival.
Congressman Charles Rangel was one figure on Capitol Hill determined to fight the president over South Africa.
We in the Congressional Black Caucus, we committed ourselves to bringing about freedom and justice in Africa.
He and other African-American members of Congress confronted Ronald Reagan and pushed for sweeping change in U.S. policy.
Apartheid became a part of our agenda, our foreign policy. So there was no meetings with any president, Nixon, Carter, Reagan, while the Jewish members may be talking about Israel and the other members may be talking about the European Union, we knew that Africa was our foreign policy.
My argument was the world knows what the United States stands against.
Former Congressman Ron Dellums.
Remember, this was in the height of the Cold War, and it was very clear that the United States stood in stark opposition to the advance of communism. I said, but on the other side of it, does the world know what we stand for? And if we stand for human rights, human dignity, etc., then we need to address the issue. I said to people, I don't know if sanctions will work. But it's the only alternative we have. We have to try it. And when we tried it, it did work.
President Reagan suffered a major defeat today, possibly the most major of his presidency.
The standoff made history in late September 1986. President Reagan, backed by American business interests, favored so-called constructive engagement with South Africa's minority rulers. He vetoed a congressional vote to impose sanctions against the apartheid regime. But Congress overrode the veto, and the Comprehensive Apartheid Act became the law of the land.
Certainly the internal debate in the United States between the approaches of constructive engagement versus sanctions is something that we had to deal with. In fact, I believe that this was the only issue with respect to which President Reagan was overridden. A veto of his of legislation passed by the Congress, the only time he was overridden by the Congress, had to do with our approach to South African policies.
The enforcement of economic sanctions alone wouldn't topple apartheid in South Africa. Voluntary disengagement by leading American institutions would also help propel Nelson Mandela on his extraordinary journey.
Nelson Mandela, as the face of standing against apartheid, really allowed for much greater understanding of what it would really mean to take this money out of there.
That part of the story when our special report from Washington continues.
This is FSN Reports with our special coverage following the death of former South African President Nelson Mandela.
Kala sa yeso vesho Welcome back. With Ronald Reagan's policy of constructive engagement towards South Africa rejected by the US Congress, a comprehensive program of economic sanctions was put into place against Nelson Mandela's jailers. Damaging though they were to the apartheid system, they were given added punch when many American institutions voluntarily concluded that it was no longer politically correct to have financial or cultural ties to white-controlled South Africa.
In 1998, before he was feted in the US Congress, Nelson Mandela made a trip to Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, one of the great institutions of American learning. A decade earlier, Harvard was one of more than 100 American universities to strip South Africa of billions of dollars in institutional investments. Under pressure from students campaigning against apartheid, the academic authorities decided South Africa was a country with which they could no longer do business. A decision for which Nelson Mandela thanked the students and faculty alike as he accepted an honorary degree.
This august institution gains its standing and reputation also from the manner in which it has conducted and continues to conduct itself as an international presence. To join the ranks of the alumni is to be reminded of the oneness of our global world.
Soon, the world's financial capital itself, New York City, followed Harvard's lead.
Well, I think sometimes people don't fully appreciate what impact money can have.
Carol Bellamy was, at the time, the president of New York City Council.
To use the power of the dollar to divest of companies that continued to do business in the apartheid regime really sent a very strong message. And in fact, when the New York City pension system divested from companies doing business in South Africa, it was at that point the largest single divestment. And so it had an impact. And I was glad that I was one of the movers on that. It wasn't just flailing your arms and saying bad, bad, bad. It said, okay, and we're going to back up our beliefs by taking action.
Nelson Mandela never forgot the impact of New York's decision to pull its money from South Africa. On his first visit to the United States, he went to the Big Apple to say thank you and won a hero's reception.
Every black in New York grew to 10 feet tall as Nelson and his wife came through.
Congressman Charles Rangel.
The crowds treated him as though he was the king of kings because they felt a sense of pride that sometimes racism denies so many of our people. But that day, we didn't need speeches, we didn't need encouragement. We didn't need self-esteem. That was our day where everyone felt that they personally knew Nelson Mandela.
That personal connection to Nelson Mandela had its roots in modern African-American history. Leaders like Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and President John F. Kennedy did not live to see the desegregated society for which they campaigned in the 1960s. And that, says former Congressman Ron Dellums, left many African-Americans yearning for a leader who, in some sense, could take their place.
It was the simplicity of it. Here's one group of people oppressing another group of people, and we were in the struggle to challenge oppression in this country. And along comes Martin Luther King, who says challenging oppression in one place is to challenge oppression everywhere. So the next logical step was to turn to South Africa as a symbol of African Americans' struggle against oppression.
Congressman Charles Rangel.
You know, in a sense, colored, Negro, African Americans, we've never had a home to call our own. There's never been anyone that we could identify with our color and our culture. And I would guess that we all adopted Nelson as being our homeland leader.
Lost on no one, the symbolism when, in the year 2000, Nelson Mandela traveled to Memphis and blessed a congregation of African Americans in the very city where the Reverend Martin Luther King's historic journey came to a premature end.
Still to come, Nelson Mandela helps save one U.S. president's bacon
and doesn't hesitate to skewer another.
I admire Nelson Mandela. I just happen to disagree with him on his view of how best to secure America.
That part of the story when our special report from Washington continues.
You're with FSN Reports, today bringing you special coverage following the death of former South African President Nelson Mandela.
Welcome back. When you've spent 27 years in prison and emerged from the experience to save your country and set an example for the world, you have earned the right to speak out on the great global issues of the day. And when it came to his relationship with successive US presidents and the American public, Nelson Mandela didn't hesitate to speak his mind.
When Nelson Mandela visited Washington in September 1998, he found the city in turmoil.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
President Bill Clinton, with whom President Mandela had enjoyed a close working relationship, had himself enjoyed too close a relationship with a White House intern named Monica Lewinsky.
The yeas are 228. The nays are 206.
Threatened with impeachment by the U.S. Congress for lying about the extent of his involvement with her, Bill Clinton's presidency was hanging by a thread. And then Nelson Mandela came to the rescue.
We are aware of the national debate that is taking place in this country about the president. And it is not our business to interfere in this matter. But we do wish to say that President Clinton is a friend of South Africa and Africa, and I believe the friend of the great mass of black people and the minorities and the disabled of the United States. We have often said that our morality does not allow us to desert our friends.
It would be too simplistic to say that Nelson Mandela saved Bill Clinton's presidency with those words, but his loyalty towards his friend in Washington certainly marked the beginning of the turnaround. Another U.S. president encountered a different type of loyalty, that expressed by Nelson Mandela and South Africa's ruling African National Congress towards President Saddam Hussein of Iraq. The ANC had been helped by Saddam during South Africa's dark days.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations.
When President George W. Bush invaded Iraq and ousted the strongman from power, Nelson Mandela accused Washington of undermining the United Nations and risking a Holocaust.
True democracy cannot be imposed nor transplanted. It must be homegrown and a product of consensus and inclusivity within any given country. That is why we disagree on the matter of Iraq.
It was a disagreement that led President Bush not even to request a meeting with the by-then former South African president during a visit to the country in 2003. But he couldn't avoid the questions the Nobel laureate had raised.
When a statesman like former South African President Nelson Mandela says the very personal things about you that he has said in the past and continues to say even this week, that's got to hurt.
My job is to make sure America is secure. And if some don't like the tactics, that's the nature of a free world where people can express their opinion. I admire Nelson Mandela. Matter of fact, my administration was the one that gave him the Medal of Freedom because of his courage and bravery. I just happen to disagree with him on his view of how best to secure America. But you can be rest assured that if I think America is threatened, I will act. And you know, I understand criticism. I mean, look, but I'm not the kind of person that runs around trying to take a poll to determine what to do.
Nelson Mandela similarly didn't take an opinion poll before he decided to act on one of the most pressing issues besetting Africa in the 1990s, the pandemic of HIV/AIDS. He watched his successor in the presidency, Thabo Mbeki, cause an international outcry by questioning the scientific link between HIV and AIDS, and hiring a health minister who told South Africans that garlic and beetroot juice could help protect them from the disease. Using his own prison identification number, 46664, Nelson Mandela launched an organization designed to combat HIV/AIDS in Africa, attacked President Mbeki's policies, and disclosed that in 2005, one of his own sons had died after contracting HIV.
It helped change the dynamic.
Former Congressman Ron Dellums.
Here's this extraordinary person now saying, no longer can we be in denial about this issue. No longer can we be silent about this issue.
Mandela's leadership on HIV/AIDS after he exited the South African presidency was just one of many partnerships he built with Americans to help improve life in Africa. For the supermodel Naomi Campbell, that meant working with the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund.
I asked him why he wanted to meet me. And why would he want to meet such a controversial person? He said, just because I know you'll spread the word. And from that day on, I just was like, I want to do things with South Africa. I want to be part of the Children's Fund. I want to help in whatever way I can.
For Carol Bellamy, the former head of UNICEF, it meant partnering with Nelson Mandela on a variety of global crises.
He just brought such credibility. Whether he spoke about debt or children or war or broke the silence, frankly, in South Africa on HIV and AIDS, nobody really had the platform that he had.
I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul.
For Morgan Freeman, it meant playing Nelson Mandela on the big screen.
Not to be too glib, I think Madiba's legacy is going to be one of endurance. It's a step above Martin Luther King's. Martin Luther King's legacy is that phrase, we shall overcome. I think Madiba's is, we can overcome. You can overcome any adversity with sufficient courage and endurance.
And for hardened politicians like Congressman Charles Rangel, it meant working on legislation with a global human rights icon.
There's a quality in all of us. If we ever stopped and paused and talked with people as Nelson did, that you can overcome that hatred. And as I said earlier, no matter what country you're in, no matter how little you knew about Africa. If someone was to tell you the Nelson Mandela story, it makes you a different person.
Today, the United States mourns Nelson Mandela along with the rest of the world. His image here forever burnished as a towering figure who not only overcame social, economic, and political adversity, but managed to win over America as well. His long march here began with questions about his political ideology and suspicions about his motivation, but ends with universal admiration for everything that he achieved. I'm Simon Marks from Washington. Goodbye.
Zangala Zavezo Vesho.